So let's just very, very quickly review last week for the benefit of those who weren't here and who were here, and for myself. It's always good to review a little bit. Just so, very quickly, we gave a history of, not a history, but an analysis of how Shavuot is presented in the Torah. It's purely an agricultural holiday. There's no mention in the Torah that there's a connection between the receiving of the Torah, the giving of the Torah, and the holiday of Shavuot, and we discussed why, because it's not important. When we got it, there's one other reason that I should have mentioned, that's sort of a historical reason, is that the Torah we got on Shavuot didn't last very long, because it was broken. It was broken 40 days later, and we did not know for 120 days or 80 days, I guess, if God would renew the covenant with the Jewish people. So we may have gotten the Torah originally on Shavuot, but was broken with the sin of the golden calf. And it's, when did we get the Torah again? When's the Torah given a second time?
Yom Kippur.
And that's why the Mishnah says that Yom Kippur is the happiest day of the year. Yom Kippur has really two contradictory emotions. It's a very happy day. God renewed the covenant. Even the fact that he judges us means we're important. Then the other hand has got that sort of fear and nervousness, and that's why Yom Kippur, that's why you have to have a meal on the ninth day. The ninth is like the holiday of Yom Kippur, and the tenth is the fast. But anyways, that's another reason we didn't mention last week, why Shavuot is not really historically, at least in the Torah itself, is not associated with the giving of the Torah. Okay, and then we discussed the story of Moshe Rabbeinu going to the Beit Midrash of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva, because he went up, God is finishing up the Torah, whatever that means, and he couldn't understand one word until Rabbi Akiva said, oh, we derived this law that was given to Moshe at Har Sinai. He still didn't understand that. That's a notion, concept developed, a scientist discovers a concept, and it's used 100 years later in ways he would have never imagined that it would be used. So that's exactly what happened in the Torah. And we kind of ended off with, with trying to resolve the contradiction. Did the Jewish people accept the Torah, you know, willingly or not? So we were all taught, I think, in kindergarten, in grade 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, the Jewish people said, Naseh v'nishma. Everybody was offered the Torah, God offered the Torah, and they said, what's in it? We don't kill, don't murder, don't commit adultery, whatever. We don't want it. That's not for us. And the Jewish people said, Naseh v'nishma, we will do and we'll listen. First, we'll agree, we trust you, and then we'll find out what's in it. On the other hand, and this is based on, we said that in the Chumash, it does say Naseh v'nishma, but that's only after the Torah was given. In the Chumash, the expression Naseh v'nishma is written in Mishpatim afterwards. And what Rashi points out, the Torah says when the Jewish people came to Mount Sinai, it says, Vayitasu b'tachti tahar. The word tachan means underneath, like literally. So it doesn't mean it literally. It means at the foot of the mountain. But why did it use such a strange language? So the rabbis explain, because God lifted up the mountains. We were literally underneath the mountain. And God said, if you accept the Torah, great. If not, I'm going to drop it on your head. Game's over. And what's amazing, we pointed out, is these two ideas appear back to back in the Talmud with no in between. The Talmud first says that God had to lift up a mountain, put it on our head. And then the Torah says, when we said Naseh v'nishma, angels came from heaven, whatever that means, and put crowns. Keter Torah, you said you were davening at Keter Torah, the crown of Torah. The crowns were put on our head, one for Naseh, one for Nishma. And then when we sinned at Chet Egel, it was taken off. And those two passages in the Talmud appear back to back, and the Talmud doesn't ask, but they contradict each other. Did the Jewish people accept the Torah willingly, or were we forced to accept the Torah? So that's where we left off last week, more or less, right? I think. Okay, so what's the answer? That's very nice. We have a nice contradiction. How do we resolve? We don't have to resolve the contradiction. The Torah is full of contradictions, right? That's the first Kaddish in the morning, right after Rabbi Shmuel. There are two verses that contradict. Until you find the third verse to resolve the contradiction. We're always full by contradictions. You make more nuance. You sharpen the idea. So did the Jewish people accept the Torah, or was it forced upon them? Which is better?
Really?
By the way, what's better? It's funny, the Talmud doesn't raise this discussion here, but there's a famous discussion Is it better to do mitzvot, like, you know, voluntarily or because you have to? What do you think? What's voluntarily? No. So the Talmud says, I believe Rav Sheshet was blind, so he said he's going to make a party because he does all the mitzvot of the Torah, even though a blind person is exempt from many of them, at least the positive mitzvot of the Torah, and he's doing them anyway. So he's going to get a great reward because he's volunteering when he doesn't have to do it. So he wants to make a big kiddush. And then they told him, Rabbi Chanina, I think, said, no, gadol mitzuva v'osa mimi sheino mitzuva v'osa. The one who's commanded and does is greater than the one who isn't commanded. So he said, I'm going to make a party if somebody's going to tell me a blind person is obligated to do mitzvot. And the Talmud says, one who's obligated gets a greater reward than one who's a volunteer. So that is counterintuitive. Everybody, whenever you ask anybody who gets, obviously a volunteer is better than one who's obligated. So there are two answers we can present. Maybe they are connected. One is the Yetzer Hara. You know, when you have to do something, what's the initial response of people when they're told they have to do something?
No.
Who the hell are you to tell me what to do? It's a free country here. We live in a democracy. I do what I want. You're not going to tell me what to do. So as soon as, what do you mean I can't eat this? You're not going to tell me what I can eat. So the fact that you're told you can't do something, you instinctively have a desire for want to do it, or as the pasuk says, "Maim genuvim yimtaku," the stolen waters are sweeter. When you do something, when you're allowed to do it, it's no big fun. It's when you're, you know, you can sneak and do something you're not supposed to do. So we have a greater Yetzer Hara. At the same time, I think in addition, we know as great as a volunteer is, you can't run an organization on volunteers. Because a volunteer, how many hours a week can you get out of a volunteer? Let's say you got the most amazing volunteer in the world, 25 hours a week. You know anybody who volunteers for anything? 25, unheard of. Can you get a volunteer to volunteer 80 hours a week? Well, if you're a lawyer or investment banker, you can get somebody to work for you 80 hours a week. He has no choice. He has a job. You bribe him a little bit. You give him a nice salary. He's going to work for you 80 hours a week. That's what it's like on Bay Street and Wall Street and these places. So... a volunteer, you know, I'm nice, it's snowing. I'm not going to go in today, it's snowing. What do you want from me? I come in all the time, I'm late. My aunt got married last night. I can't be at the 7 o'clock meeting in the morning. But if you're obligated to be at the 7 o'clock meeting, you'll be at the 7 o'clock meeting. So therefore, as much as yes on the idea, the volunteer, in a sense, it sounds better, really you're better off being obligated. Which, by the way, this relates to another idea of the Rambam. One idea leads to another. The Rambam has a division of the mitzvot where he discusses what should be our, why should we do mitzvot? Should we do mitzvot because now we're not talking about obligation to volunteer? Mitzvot means obligation. That's what the word mitzvah means. But should you want to do the mitzvot or should you do mitzvot because you have to? In other words, the famous case, the Rambam says, have a nice cheeseburger. Piece of pork sitting here. Should you say, ugh, it's disgusting? Or should you say, I would love to eat it, but I won't eat it. God told me I can't eat it. Which is better?
To say, God cannot eat it.
Right. So that's the famous Rambam. The Rambam quotes, I think I mentioned this once before. The Rambam quotes the Greek philosophers who say it's better to be turned off by the meat. If God says you can't eat it, how could you have a desire to do something that God doesn't want you to do? It's terrible. You should hate the meat. The Rambam says no, because in the Rambam's mindset, because there's no reason to keep kosher. If the offer is, you can be the nicest person in the world. You can be honest, you can be a great person and not keep kosher. It does not make you a bad person. The Torah demands we keep kosher. So you should say, I would love to eat this. I would love to eat this meat, but I can't because God says. It's funny, when you're brought up your whole life, you know, keeping kosher, you have no desire to eat non-kosher. Maybe that's unfortunate. Maybe I'm in violation of the Rambam. I don't have a desire to eat non-kosher food. I may have a desire to do other things that are wrong, but eating non-kosher food isn't one of them. It's just not, when you grow up keeping kosher, it's instinctive. It's like going on the moon, like you see non-kosher food, it doesn't enter your mind that you'd ever want to eat. It's not a struggle, am I going to eat it? You have a business deal that's a little bit great, that's like a struggle, you know, that's hard. But the kosher, now the Rambam says that's only true by the rituals, In other words, the mitzvot that have no that we would never come up on our own. If God had commanded, shatnes, I can't wear wool and linen together. Who cares? I bet that's an obscure law in the Torah, but it's a law in the Torah. So you walk into any fancy clothing store and you have a keep on your head, they know right away. They not to you can't show that suit, you can't buy. Mm-hmm. Only expensive suits have it. You're like at Harry Rosen, they'll have it, but they won't have it at the. It's fancy suits have linen. They know anybody in clothing. There's a shatnez lab here. Like Bathurst and Wilson. Anyway, so that you don't have to say it's disgusting, whatever. But when it comes to laws of an ethical nature, you shouldn't say, I would love to steal. That's what the Rambam makes the distinction. No, because you could argue, I want to cheat on my taxes. I really do. The government's a bunch of crooks. What, they waste their money and this and that. Why should I pay so much? And they don't support Jewish education. They support the Catholics. It's discriminatory. So I want to cheat on my taxes. But I'm not going to. Right, so no, the Rambam says to steal. That's we assume that cheating on taxes is a form of theft. So you're supposed to say, I would never want to do such a thing. Because that's a moral character. The Torah is supposed to make us into better moral people. So you shouldn't, it's better a person say, I wish I was stealing and I don't steal, than he steals. But when it comes to moral behavior, ethics, the Rambam said you should want to do it, which basically means that we keep ethics in a certain sense independent of the Torah. We keep ethics because it's the right thing to do. God happened to command, we also have to do that in the Torah. So that you should want to do. You should develop your personality. You want to be a nice person. You want to help person. You don't want to gossip. You don't want to cheat people, etc. But when it comes to rituals, you can say, I really wish I could violate this, but I won't do it. And that's the ideal. There's certain mitzvot that are sort of like in the middle. Like it's not clear. It's very interesting. By the way, the Rambam includes sexual sins in the area where a person should say, I wish I could do it, but I won't do it. In other words, I don't think the Rambam would have said that by adultery, because adultery is an ethical sin. But let's say two single people, that's not necessarily the way I understand what the Rambam's saying. He doesn't develop this theme, but he just used the word, when he's giving examples of this, so arayot, Sefer Shuns is one of the examples he gives. So presumably the Rambam would hold that two consenting adults who are not married, don't have any people they're hurting, so to speak, then it's only wrong because it says in Torah. I don't know, but I throw that out. In the society we live in, homosexuality perhaps falls into this category where there's nothing necessarily ethically wrong with it, if not for the fact that Torah said so. I don't know. It's a complicated area. This is what happens when you come, you get the fence of all the people who missed it. Don't tell them. But no, that's not a simple thing. But the Rambam, you have to think about this. In other words, because there's certain mitzvot, it's not clear why, and it's obviously it's a combination. And of course, not to misunderstand, of course we believe that the laws of kashrut also have ethical underpinnings. But that's only after the fact. In other words, we would have never made up the fact that they have to keep kosher. But once we have to keep kosher so we can find ethical meaning, the way we have to slaughter, we can't eat blood because blood is life. We only eat domesticated animals. We have to feed our animals before we eat. I mean, there are all kinds of things we can learn that are ethical discipline, but fundamentally, there's no ethical reason to keep kosher. That's sort of after the facts. All right, it's a big area. So all this ties in. So is it better is it better the Jewish people were forced to accept the Torah or they wanted to accept the Torah? It's not really the same. It's sort of different questions related. I would think Nasav and Ishmael is the better approach. That's great. Look, the Jews were so eager. Later on, you can find out they didn't even know what was in it. They didn't know what they were accepting. But
what do you mean by better?
In other words, In other words, is it a lack? I presume it is. Is there something wrong with the fact that the Jewish people had to be forced to keep the Torah, or is it better that they ideally that they accepted the Torah willingly?
But not in terms of like schar and onesh.
Right. I mean, I think historically, that was not relevant at the time. For us, in other words,
willingly without knowing.
Right, so the truth of the matter is the Talmud itself says that the Jewish people are an amma paziza, what's the word, impetuous, like we act without thinking, right? What kind of idiot accepts the Torah without knowing what's in it? Who signs a contract without reading it? Only idiots do that. So the Jewish people said, we're a little bit not normal. It wasn't not normal. But I think they were saying in a very positive way, God took us out of Egypt, we split the sea. In other words, he had a track record. It's not like that. And we have to trust God. But there is a certain craziness to accept the Torah without knowing what's in it. And I mean, all this is a midrash. I mean, you know, I don't think, if the Jewish people had said no, according to this other midrash, it never says they said no. It just said God lifted the mountain on top of them. Why?
We're still thinking.
Yeah, right. So the Talmud then says, as I mentioned last week, that the Gemara says, now I have a good excuse. I don't keep the Torah. It was forced upon me. I don't have to keep the Torah. God, what do you want from me? I never agreed to accept it. You can't hold a gun to somebody. But according to Gemara, says that worked only until Purim. Because on Purim, the Jewish people accept the Torah willingly. And we know Yom Kippur Purim, right? Yom Kippurim, we discussed that in our Purim classes. So you see already there are three dates for the date of the Torah. The date, Zman Matan Torah Teinu, is Shavuot. But really, that Torah was broken and was given on Yom Kippur. And Yom Kippur is the day of Kabbalah Torah. And then somehow Purim becomes Kimu V'Kiblu, Kimu Masha Kiblu Kfar. The Jewish people re-accepted the Torah. And that's probably why the sages made Purim into a holiday. Now, and we put it all together, what do they accept on Purim? What do they accept? So let's try to resolve the contradiction. Maybe we can tie them to Purim. So how could the Jewish people accept the Torah willingly and not willingly? Any ideas? Should we resolve the contradiction? Yeah, so you could say it's not a contradiction. Parts of it, we're always like that. We do a lot of things. On the one hand, we really want to do them, but sometimes, like before you get married, let's say. People get cold feet or whatever. Now, there's all kinds of decisions. You're very excited, but then, you know, you're kind of nervous before you want to do something. So that could very well be. In other words, the Jewish people did say Nasa v'nishma, but when they saw the thunder and the lightning and the next, and then all of a sudden, maybe this is not for us. So God said, no, you agreed already. You can't back out now. You know, so you have that. So you reach the point of no return. I'm going to hold the mountain over your head. You're finished. You have no choice but to accept the Torah. That could be one approach. What else? So one common approach, I think mentioned in the Medrash Tanchuma, is that depends what we mean by Torah. There are parts of the Torah the Jewish people accepted willingly and not willingly, and basically they divided between the written and the oral law. The Torah Shebichtav, basically, which what God said, what God wrote in Vayidaber Hashem Moshe Lemor, God spoke to Moshe, so that part the Jewish people were willing to accept. But the rabbis say, all the oral interpretation, who are you rabbis? A bunch of rabbis say, Torah means this. Why do we have to listen? You get this all the time. You get this all the time. Jews, you know, where does it say in Torah you can't drive a car around Shabbat? It doesn't say anywhere in the Torah. The rabbis made it up, right? You hear things like that all the time. Where does it say you can't eat? By the way, where does it say in Torah you can't eat meat and milk? It doesn't say it anywhere in the Torah. So you can't cook a kid in its mother's milk. I don't know anybody who's ever cooked a kid in its mother's milk. I know lots of people who mix meat and milk. I don't know anybody who violates what the verse says, but that's a rabbinic interpretation of the verse, right? Whatever. So that's what some say, that the Jewish people were willing to accept the written Torah, but the oral Torah that they weren't willing to accept on Purim. That's what they accept on Purim. What's the oral Torah? What's hidden? Purim is all about everything is hidden beneath the surface. That's the oral Torah, digging, you know, below the surface. So the written Torah they accepted on Shavuot, what God said. And the Shumah, the oral Torah, only begins to develop, really, at the time of Purim. During the first temple period, you didn't have much of an oral Torah. Yes?
When the Ethiopian Jews were rescued, they did not have an oral tradition. And when they relocated to Israel.
Right.
The rabbis had a lot of trouble.
Correct. Yeah.
The rabbis had a lot of trouble.
Right.
Because they didn't
see, I mean, that's what the Karaites were.
The
I mean, we've had battles like this since the beginning of the Oral Law. The Sadducees, the Tzdukim and the Prushim, the Tzdukim, and it's one of the famous battles is on the holiday of Shavuot. Because it says in the Torah, Usfartem lachem mimacharet ha-shabbat. So when is Shavuot? It doesn't have a date in the Torah. It's 7 weeks after Pesach. But the simple meaning, it says you should bring a sacrifice on Pesach, celebrate Pesach, and then Usfartem lachem mimacharet ha-shabbat. So what does that sound like when they start to count? I know when they start to count.
The end.
Mimacharet ha-shabbat means what? The day after the first Shabbat, so you count on Sunday. That's what the Tzukim said. They'd be very happy this year that Shavuot falls on a Sunday. But most years, it doesn't fall on a Sunday. The Tzukim insisted, and that was a huge debate in the Talmud. That's one of the famous debates. And the truth of the matter, the simple reading of the Torah, of course the Tzukim are right. The question is, why does Rabbinic Judaism not accept that interpretation? It's not why did the Tzukim say Mirachat HaShabbat is Sunday is no question. That's easy to understand. The question is, why do we reject that argument? We don't wait till Sunday to count Sefirah. We assume Pesach is Shabbat. Well, whatever the answer to that question is. But it's not these people, and the Karaites were sort of their, I don't know, they're connected. I'm not... big scholar, the exact relationship between the Tzukim and the Karaites, it's 800 years later. But the Karaites start, let's say, in the 9th century, more or less. And for hundreds of years, they're the majority of the Jewish people. Rav Sajak, even in the time of the Rambam, some scholar, I believe, Dr. Chorsky, Professor Chorsky, late Professor Chorsky at Harvard, Rav Soloveitchik's son-in-law, claims that that's one of the reasons the Rambam wrote the Mishnah Torah was an attack on the Karaites. That's not the only reason. But the Karaites were very strong for hundreds of years. Rav Sagan, the Karaites don't really exist anymore. There are a few hundred around the world somewhere. But because they rejected the oral law. Where do the rabbis make up this stuff? But you saw what happened. They're not around, and we are. In other words, you can't live without the oral law. But you always have to ask, ayin tachat ayin. That's in sort of classic example, an eye for an eye. But the Torah says an eye for an eye, but the rabbi said it doesn't mean an eye for an eye. So the Bible critics say, well, it does mean an eye for an eye. Just the rabbis, that was, at that time, that was accepted punishment. Today, it's barbaric. Humanity... is more advanced, which I don't know how true that is, but we're more advanced in their weapons of mass destruction also. The rabbis wanted it to tone down. So it's not a silly argument. There's a logic to it. They're not idiots for saying that. So I remember my uncle told me, we don't accept that. We accept it never meant an eye. It always meant money. Because it's impossible an eye doesn't compensate for an eye. What? Of course, money also doesn't compensate. But so why does the Torah write an eye for an eye? For that reason, because it would be disgusting for the Torah to write, pay money, and that's how you pay for an eye. That's a terrible thing. The Germans can pay like reparations money for the Holocaust. That's awful. That's why Menachem Begin was against it. He didn't want it. Rav Soloveitchik was against the reparation money. Okay, I'm not saying we shouldn't have thing, and I think it proved it was good, but we don't want to think you can pay money. So the Torah would never write you can pay money for an eye. That's just one example. But you always have to ask yourself, whenever the rabbis have an oral interpretation, what is the basis? Why are they saying it? What anomalies in the text? Usually there's a textual reason. And the Macharet HaShabbat, the rabbis have textual proofs that the word of Shabbat doesn't just mean this, on the Friday night show, but it means the first day of Pesach also. But that was the big debate, but that's one of the interpretations. So the Jewish people, everybody was willing. The Karaites, the Tzukim, everybody was always willing to accept the written Torah. It's really only in the modern era, only with the advent of Reform. The Reform movement, as far as I know, was the first major Jewish movement to reject parts of the written Torah. That's new. It took till the 18th century, Wellhausen and biblical criticism, to come up with the notion that the Torah wasn't written by God. I think all of humanity, anybody in the world that influenced by the Torah, the whatever, Muslim, Jew, everybody believed until the 19th century, everybody believed the Torah was the word of God. That's still what classical Judaism believes. There may be a word here, a word there. We're not getting into in the nitty-gritty, but fundamentally, we believe the Torah was written more or less. The Rambam says more, word for word, letter for letter, dictated by God. So everybody always accepted it. The Keres and the Tzedukim accepted the written Torah. Their argument was only on the oral Torah. The Reform movement rejected part of the oral Torah, because once you say the written law is man-made, so of course you can reject it. I agree. If the Torah is written by man, so we changed in 4,000 years. But if the Torah is written by God, you're not going to change it quite so simply. But we discussed last week, or when did we discuss Rav Elazar, Rav Yeshua, Torah B'lo Shemayim, even with the God, we can, it's fluid. Torah lo b'shamayim, he once the Torah was given, we have to interpret it. But we have to interpret it based on the rules of the Torah. This is a broader topic. But that's sort of a very clear explanation. The Jewish people willingly accept it, but they had to be forced to accept the oral law, perhaps. But I like with both. We accept the Torah willingly and not willingly at the same time. We accepted it, but we had to be forced to accept it. All right, any questions? Nolene, any questions?
No, but I think I got what you
saying. I hope so. I mean, you missed part of it.
David too, because you couldn't
count. I'm sorry. Okay. All right. So if not, so then we'll. I want to discuss. Yeah, okay, we discussed last week what happened at Sinai. We don't really know what happened at Sinai. How much of the Torah was given at Sinai? We spent a few minutes on that. It's clear, it seems to be pretty clear that not the whole Torah was given at Sinai. Things developed over time. And, you know, obviously the stories in the desert happened way after the events at Sinai. But I want to discuss the basic belief that the oral Torah and the written Torah both were given at Sinai. But I want to discuss the concept of 600 and 13 mitzvot for a few minutes. Tariyag mitzvot. I like discussing it when I get a chat, because I think there's a lot of misinformation. There's a lot of misunderstanding of what does it mean there's 613 mitzvot in the Torah. Most Jews know that, right? That's why we eat pomegranates, right? Rosh Hashanah, everybody know that one? Has anybody ever counted the pomegranates? Like, if you believe all the fairy tales, they tell you, like, in grade two. I'm sorry. I don't know. I maybe there is a pomegranate that has 613 seeds, but that's what they taught me, right, in kindergarten. You know, we eat pomegranate because we say, no, what the Medrash does say, that the Rimon is, we eat pomegranates, Rosh Hashanah, because it's Malay. The Jewish people are Malay mitzvot like Rimon, which Jewish people are wonderful. There's so many mitzvot, I say hello to somebody. That's a mitzvah. I fulfill a mitzvah. I'm nice. I smile at somebody. So we have so many opportunities to do mitzvot. We're full of mitzvot like a pomegranate is full of seeds. But it didn't mean 613. But the Medrash does say that the reason to eat a pomegranate is because Malay mitzvot, we want to show how we're full of mitzvot. But anyway, so let's discuss for a few minutes, where does the notion of 613 mitzvot, you know, come from? And more importantly, what does it mean? We could give a few years of classes here on this. What are the 613 mitzvot? That would keep us busy for the next 20 years, Marshall. You want to... 10 years, 5 years, 5 years.
I want to know if it only has 612.
Right. So we discussed that last week. We discussed that last week. That's why certain people say belief in God is not a mitzvah. It's a condition of the mitzvah. But in other words, it's not... belief in God is the basis on which mitzvot are built, but it's not a mitzvah, because otherwise I keep 612 mitzvot. Belief in God, it's not for me. I keep kashrut, Shabbos, that I do, Pesach, but I don't believe in God. But by the way, that's what's called, I mean, it's not exactly, but the term social orthodoxy. This was, anybody hear of the term social orthodoxy? This was coined about 3-4 years ago. Some guy wrote an article in, I forget what magazine, he wrote an article saying basically he's socially orthodox. He keeps kosher, he keeps Shabbos, he goes to shul every Shabbos, so he loves the it's a beautiful lifestyle. But he doesn't, I don't think he said he denies, I don't think he said he doesn't know if he believes, he doesn't really believe in the whole system. He doesn't believe in it, but he thinks it's good. It's a good idea. It's good for the community, it's good practice, it develops community. So they coined this term, social orthodoxy. He does, I mean, the whole term orthodoxy is a new term, but it means he follows orthodox practice, but he doesn't necessarily buy into the whole system. There are probably a lot of people like that. There are a lot of people like that. But whatever, some are afraid to leave, and some, it's a nice, comfortable life. They actually like the lifestyle without necessarily believing. But anyway, so where does this, so the idea, it's not as crazy as it sounds for someone to say, I don't believe in God, but I keep Pesach, I mean, it sounds insane, and it is insane, but it's But the Rambam, of course, the Rambam disagrees. The Rambam says the first mitzvah of the Torah is belief in God. The question is, what is it? Belief in God, knowledge of God, the study of how do you fulfill that mitzvah? It's not just means I believe in God. It means you have to know God. The Rambam means you have to know God. Whatever that, you have to study Torah or nature or metaphysics, maybe. That's how you know God. Science, but anyways, but those are, if we continue on that, we'll discuss that a little bit. But where's the concept of 613 mitzvot? And if you want to look up a list of the 613 mitzvot, you want to know. I told my kids in chat, it's never happened. I should tell them the beginning of the year. I told them, if you write on your exam, or you can do it before the exam, it's the 613 mitzvot of the Torah, I'll give you 100 in the course. Even if you got a zero on every test of the year, I don't care. If you know the 613 mitzvot in my class, you will get 100 in this course. No kid has ever taken me up on the offer. So the kids ask me, can I do it? I say, no, I could not name all 613 mitzvot off the top of my head like that. No, I couldn't do it. So I'm not, but if you want to look up a list of the 613 mitzvot, where are you going to find it?
Google.
I'm sorry?
Google.
I
don't think you can.
Yeah, so before Google, before Safari. Okay, what masechet in the Talmud might it be in? It's a trick question, right? And so it's never mentioned in the Talmud. Matter of fact, the idea that there's 613 or Taryag, Taf Resh Yud Gimel, mitzvot is mentioned, as far as I know, twice in very obscure, but very non-legal discussion. This is not an issue that concerned the Gemara at all. There's a famous piece in Makot that we might get to, and the Gemara in Shabbos talks about it, that there, it just in passing mentions the idea of 613 mitzvot, but it's never developed, and the Talmud never gives a list. And the Talmud, in other words, it clearly wasn't a big, just like when we got the Torah, wasn't a big deal for the Torah. It just wasn't a big deal. The Torah didn't concern itself with it. Today, that's how we celebrate the holiday of Shavuot. So what the 613 mitzvot was just didn't concern our sages. You do what you have to do. First of all, there are millions of mitzvot, but in the Middle Ages, this became a big topic. Everybody wrote a book on the 613 mitzvot. It became, people got excited on the topic. So where's the first list? So where are you going to look? So if you look in the Talmud, you ain't going to find it. And the Ramban, I'll give you a secret, the Ramban, Nachmanides, 1194, let's say, to 1271, in Spain, and then he lived the later years of his life in Israel, the last few years of his life. The Ramban, Rav Moshe ben Nachman, so he questions, maybe they're not 613 mitzvot, maybe it's a rough simlai. Some not such a famous Talmudic rabbi. He's quoted a few times here and there. I mean, not to put him down, God forbid, but he's not like a Bai Rav, a Hillel Shammai, Rabbi Akiva. He's not the... So Rav Simlai makes a statement that there's 613 mitzvot given to the Jewish people. What's it based on? So this is the Gemara in Makot. This is the Gemara I'm talking about. This is the main source. How does he know there's 613 mitzvot? Because the verse says, it's a strange way to derive it, Torah tziva lanu Moshe. Torah tziva lanu Moshe. So what's the gematria of Torah? What's the numerical value of Torah? Taf, 400. Vav, 406. Resh, 606. Hey, 611. Ah, that's 611. That's Moshe. Anochi, the lo yelecha, what we discussed last week, this is assuming it is two mitzvot apparently. Anochi and lo yeh were spoken by God. Because it says it's in first person, I am the Lord your God. By the third commandment, it was too intense. That's the simple reading of the Chumash, although not everybody agrees with that reading, but that's the simple reading. The third mitzvot, so God gave the first two commandments, or two of, and so Torah Tziva Lanu Moshe, 611 plus 2 is 613. That's the Gemara in Makot. That's the source. But the Gemara never follows up what they are listing. And then it says 248, like positive, that we know, the limbs of the body, supposedly. I don't know if I have to speak to a doctor. I don't know what there is. And 365, negative of the days of the year. You know, every day has a mitzvah. By the way, there is in the Zohar, apparently, they list off I don't know if they do it for every day, but every day of the year has a mitzvah. I know because somebody once gave a hoshir on Tisha B'Av. The mitzvah lo tasei for the ninth of Av is Gid Hanasha. Yaakov Avinu fighting with the angel, counting the sciatic nerves. Every day from the, whatever. So the 365 days, it means the mitzvot are interconnected. In other words, some mitzvot are the heart, are like the heart. Shabbat's like the heart. You die if the Jewish people don't observe Shabbat. More than the Jewish people kept Shabbat, Shabbat kept the Jews. So they're vital organs. We need Shabbos, and we need certain things that keep us alive. Then you need fingers. That's part of your limbs, body. You can live without a finger. But it's disjointed. You're missing a finger. The body doesn't look right. There's something wrong. But okay, you can. So all the mitzvot form an integrated whole. The body, it's working together. And of course, every day of the year. So you can already see it's a symbolic idea. And towards even Moshe. But it's also strange. We don't generally learn halacha from numerical values of the. I mean, it's not a halacha. It's not a. Not a really. Who cares? So the Ramban questions whether we accept this teaching of Rav Simlai. Maybe we don't accept it, because the Gemara never follows up on it. The Gemara, when you have a debate, Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Shmuel debate, is this a mitzvah, that a mitzvah, the Gemara never says, well, if he doesn't count it as a mitzvah, how's he going to fill his quota of 613? What mitzvah does he have? So the Ramban questions it. Where does the Ramban question? The Ramban questions it on his first comment in the Sefer Mitzvot of the Rambam. So the Rambam wrote all of Jewish law, and he called this book
Mishnah Torah.
The Mishnah Torah. Why do you call it the Mishnah Torah? I always say this is the most difficult Rambam of them all. Why did the Rambam, when you learn in yeshiva, the mark of a sharp yeshiva student is he can answer a contradiction in the Rambam. The Rambam, give a chiddush in the Rambam, a new insight. Rabbi Soloveitchik would spend, the Brisker spent their whole life giving 5-hour classes, understanding a Rambam here, a Rambam there, how did the Rambam seems to contradict himself. That's what they do. That's how they live. The Rambam is like the be all and end all almost. So so why did the Rambam? So the answer a new Rambam, but this is the most difficult Rambam of them all. Why does the Rambam call this book the Mishnah Torah? What does Mishnah Torah mean? Second Torah, a review of the Torah, right? So the Rambam writes, I'm doing this because I'm going to be like Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, the editor of the Mishnah was, and I'm going to summarize, over hundreds of years, you have to put it organized, and then you're going to read my book, and you're going to know everything you have to know about Jewish law, nothing else. And the Rambam writes, you're going to need two books in your library. You're going to need a Torah, the Tanakh, and my book. And I'm therefore calling it Mishnah Torah. It's like the second Torah. So people didn't like that. That sounded a little bit too much. So they renamed it the Yad HaChazakah, the strong arm, because there are 14 books. The Rambam divided Jewish law into 14 books. Sefer Mata, Ahava, Zmanim, Nashim, Kedusha, Tahara, whatever. 14 books of the Rambam, Mishpatim, Shoftim. So they call it Yad HaChazakah. That's what the Rambam writes. So what's the Rambam? He's teaching you the entire Torah. What's the entire Torah? It's the 613 mitzvot. So basically, the Mishnah Torah is a writing down of all the 613 mitzvot. So the Rambam wrote an introduction to the Mishnah Torah. And he called that book, it's Sefer HaMitzvot, the Book of Mitzvot. And that Book of Mitzvot lists off the 613 mitzvot. Now, I didn't bring mine with me, but next time I can bring it. So you have the beginning series, but there are two lines of the Rambam, and 98% of the page is all the commentaries on the Rambam, the fighting with the Rambam, and etc. And then the end part's not so much. Then once that's his, the introduction to the introduction, in other words, he has to write the 613 mitzvot. And by the way, when you learn the Rambam in the Mishnah Torah, whenever you come to a section, the Rambam will tell you how many mitzvot there are here, and I will then explain all these mitzvot in the following chapter. So for Hilchot Tefillah, there are two mitzvot, let's say. The laws of tshuva, there's one mitzvah to do tshuva. Shabbat, there are five mitzvot on Shabbat. And one, and he'll list off the laws of monetary damages. I don't remember the number. The laws of idolatry, I think there are 51 laws relating to idolatry. And in these chapters, I will explain these 50, that's how he introduces. So he wrote the 613 mitzvot, but then he had to tell you what was his formula, since the 613 mitzvot are not listed anywhere. So how's he figuring out? I've never done this, but he's trying to experiment. give your kids or your grandkids or your wife or your husband or whatever a chumash and take parsha mishpatim. Say, write all the mitzvot that appear in this parsha. Read the Torah. Figure out what's a mitzvah, what's not. Parsha Ki Teitse is the most mitzvah in the Torah, 74 mitzvot according to the count of Rambam. Open up Ki Teitse and see if you can come up with 74 mitzvot. Maybe you'll come up with 94, maybe 51. It's not simple at all to figure out what the mitzvot, what counts as a mitzvah in the Torah. So the Rambam has to tell you, how did he figure out what are the mitzvot? So there are 14 rules the Rambam used, because what counts as a mitzvah? How many mitzvot are there on Shabbat? Well, there are 39 forbidden activities. So is each one of those forbidden activities a separate mitzvah or not? And within those forbidden activities, there are 5 million sub-activities. So are those sub-activities a mitzvah or not? So, and then you have to build a mishkan. So is building the Aron and the Shulchan one mitzvah or two mitzvah? So it's very complicated. So the Rambam has to give you all these rules to figure out how do you get down to 613. So he gives you 14 rules. Gives you 14 rules that he uses. It's on those 14 rules that there's lots of discussion. So on the first rule of the Rambam, because the Rambam is not the first person to write the 613 mitzvot. The first person is the Bahag, the Baal Halachot Gedolot, which was written in the 8th century. We are not 100% sure who wrote the book. I forget now. Rav Kirana, I forget now exactly who. The Baal HaLachot Gedolot, he's quoted in the Tosfots occasionally. So he's the first one to write a list. And his book, that was pretty much after the Shiltot, one of the first books written after the close of the Talmud, around the 8th century or so, maybe the 9th century. And he wrote, the author, the Baal HaLachot Gedolot, many laws, new laws, new cases, technology advance, you know, from time to time, we need new books. So he wrote a book, Baal HaLachot Gedolot, and in his book, he wrote an introduction. He wrote the 613 mitzvot. Rav Sa'atya Gaon wrote a poem that was used to be read, I think still is still read in some shuls, maybe in, I don't know, Iraq, Libya, I don't know where they used to read it. He wrote a poem to be read on Shavuot, of the 613 mitzvot, which he also wrote, I think, a second poem, placing each one of the 613 mitzvot to the Aseret HaDibrot. Each one of the Aseret HaDibrot are the 10 categories, and every mitzvah can fall into one of the Aseret HaDibrot, and therefore that's why the Aseret HaDibrot are so important. They're like the general mitzvot and the detailed mitzvot underneath. So the first rule of the Rambam is you cannot count the rabbinic mitzvah. That's in other words, lighting Hanukkah candles and listening to the Megillah and washing our hands before we eat bread and saying Hallel on Yontif, is not one of the 613 mitzvot, because it says God gave at Sinai 613 mitzvot, and this is after Sinai. It cannot be counted as a mitzvah. And the Rambam writes, this is really obvious, and I feel like an idiot. He doesn't quite say this, but you know, why am I saying this? It's so obvious. So I'm saying this because there was this guy, the Bahag, and he didn't know what he was talking about. He was some, I don't know, how he even made it as a rabbi. What the Rambam never, he didn't have any patience for, you know, he laid out the laws. He said this, and he wipes the floor, in part of my language, with the Bahag. And he goes to town, what an idiot. I mean, God forbid, but what a... And the Ramban comes to the defense of the Bahag. The Ramban always did that in Jewish history. The Ramban was the big peacemaker. He tried, when all they were burning the books of the Rambam. So the Ramban didn't like a lot of what the Rambam did. He disagreed with a lot. But he recognized the Rambam was a great, unbelievable genius, unbelievable contribution. We can disagree without burning his books. Let's calm down the rhetoric. When the Baal HaMor wrote an attack on the Rif, one of the first commentators in Talmud, ripping the Rif apart, so the Ramban comes to the defense. And the Ramban often comes to the defense of the Bahag, and he writes, I really agree with the Rambam. I really agree with the Rambam. But I'm going to explain why the Bahag could be right. In other words, the Ramban would say why the Bahag is like, doesn't know what he's talking about. The Rambam said, you're right, but tone down the language. The Bahag wasn't an idiot. He knew what he was talking about. And we can explain what he did. So the first one of the 14 rules is you don't count the rabbinic mitzvah, because that can't be. And the Ramban then says, well, who says there's 613 mitzvah? Where does this come from? Rav Simlai? I don't know. The Jewish, do we accept that view? Is it codified anywhere? The Talmud didn't talk about it. They didn't care. So he questions the whole notion of 613 mitzvah. But he says already he's living in the 12th century, the 13th century. By his time, Every Jew knows from their taught in kindergarten. That's why we eat the pomegranates on Rosh Hashanah. There's 613 mitzvot. Everybody knows that. You can stop a Jew on the street who knows almost nothing about Judaism, but you ask him how many mitzvot there in Torah. Half of them will know there's 613. That's a you go on Clark Avenue, so you go to the shuls at 613 Clark Avenue. 613. That's the number, right? That's the magic number. So. Okay, I'm going to accept their 613 mitzvot too. And then he writes to defend the B'hag, why you can count the rabbinic mitzvah. You can count the rabbinic mitzvot in the 613, maybe. And then the Ramban, and then in each one of the mitzvot, they comment and comes to the Megillah Esther, comes to the fence, and the Rambam and the Ramban, basically what I'm telling you now is there is no agreed upon list of 613 mitzvot. You won't find one. There is no list that we agree. How can we agree on what the mitzvot are? Can't we agree what we have to do? Right? We can't. There's no list of 613 mitzvot that everybody agrees. The Rambam and the Ramban had a disagreement on 31 of the mitzvot. Of the 613 mitzvot that the Rambam writes, the Ramban disagrees with 31 of them. So, and he replaces them. In other words, he does do the replacement, like, okay, you forgot this, got out this, you added, you said this. No, that's not really a mitzvah. Now, the question is, what does it all mean? I have to finish soon, but because there's a lot more to discuss. But who cares? So what I was saying. There's a notion of 613 mitzvot. Rav Simlai said this was given at Sinai. That's what happened at Mount Sinai. God gave Moshe the Torah. Torah tziva lana Moshe. Morashah kilat Yaakov, 611 plus 2, 613 mitzvot. And that's what the Rambam's whole book is about, the Mishnah Torah. So, so I guess I'll answer this and we'll say one basic point and then we'll have to leave it there. The second rule of the Rambam, the first rule of the Rambam in 613 mitzvot is if it's made up by the rabbis, you still have to keep it. There's a mitzvah in the Torah to listen to the rabbis. There's a mitzvah, but that doesn't mean lighting Chanukah candles is a biblical mitzvah. The Talmud asks, how can you make a bracha when you light the Chanukah candles? Asher kishanu b'mitzvot avitzivanu. Well, it's not true. God did not command us to light Chanukah candles. The rabbis commanded us. So how can we do it? That's a question of the Talmud. Maybe you're saying God's name in vain, a violation of the Ten Commandments, by making a bracha. It's a good question. Of course, it says, no, lo tasur. It says in the Torah, you have to listen to the rabbis. Whatever the rabbis say, that's what God wants you to do. You know what? I mean, there are rules. Rabbis can't say whatever they want. I mean, that's another how that works. But if the sages make up a rule, it's accepted. We have to follow it. So even though God never told us to light Chanukah candles, he told us to listen to the sages, and the sages told us to light the Chanukah candles. Therefore, we have to light the Chanukah candles, and therefore we can make a bracha, a shirki shana mishutah. So rule number one, no rabbinic mitzvah. Rule number two of the Rambam, and this gets rid of about 98% of the obligations that a Jew does. Rule number two is that anything that is derived from the oral law, anything that's not explicitly written in the text, if it's an extra word, one we call like the Yud Gimel Mitot Shatorah Nidreshet Bahem, the 13 hermeneutical principles of Rabbi Shmuel, we say every morning. Rabbi, that's what we said. Shnei Ktivim Makshim said anything derived from, you have a minor principle and a major principle. So that's what you do. So anything like that, the Rambam says that doesn't count as a mitzvah. Only if it's written explicitly in the text. So here I'll say my chiddush, I think, and then we'll call it an evening. Why is that? 98% of the 39 melachot of Shabbat are not written in the Torah. One of them is written, don't light a fire. So who says you can't cook, you can't plow a field? Well, it's not written anywhere in the Torah. It's the right, because it's written next to the Mishkan, and they couldn't do this in the Mishkan, whatever, it's the right. That's how most of the Torah is. Most of the Torah is not written explicitly. The Rambam says none of those, the Rambam doesn't say they're not a biblical law. Just because it's not a 613 mitzvot doesn't mean it's a rabbinic law. You can have a biblical law, it's just not counted as one of the 613 mitzvot. So then who cares what the 613 mitzvot is? So on a certain level, you're right, who cares? It really doesn't matter. And the Talmudic sages were not concerned. That's on one level. On the second level is what this probably has to do with what the Rambam says, and this is will lead us to more discussions in the future, I hope, one day. is anything that's written in Torah, we're going with our premise God gave the Torah and everybody accepts, you know, it's written by God. So whatever written in Torah cannot be changed. Like, that's immutable for all time. And the Rambam says anybody who changes the Torah is a heretic, he loses share in the world to come. I mean, that's it. That's the word of God, cannot break it. But an interpretation of the word of God, that can change. That can change. We today don't have the power to change it. But when there's a Sanhedrin, when there will be, when there was, Sanhedrin's changed all. So there, for example, it's the holiday of Shavuot. And we are all here, or many of us, because who converted? Ruth converted. Is Ruth allowed to convert according to Jewish law? So according to Jewish law, until the time of Ruth was not allowed to convert. Why not? Because there's a verse in the Bible. Amoni. Lo yavo Amoni Moavi b'kal Hashem. Ammoni or woman, she was from Moab, cannot come. That's why the whole story of Ruth, the people didn't want to marry her. Get her out of here. She can't convert. She's a Moabite woman. What happened? The rabbis came up with an ingenious interpretation. Moaviva lo Moavit. A male, not a male, but not a, why not? Because it said, because they didn't, in the time of war, they didn't go out. So only men go to war, not the woman, though. It's interesting. So therefore, it doesn't apply to women. What does that mean? It means 50 years later, had Ruth converted, her conversion would have been invalid. The law changed. Now, what changed? Not the Torah. There's no verse in the Torah. What changed is the rabbi's understanding of the verse. So when something is written, that's permanent. But change, but interpretation, things can change when you have a Sanhedrin. Since the Rambam's basic principle is the Torah is eternal, the Rambam cannot count anything that's derived from interpretation, because that might change one day. That means the Torah is going to change. The 613 mitzvot is a description of God. The written word of the Torah is the word, is God. The interpretation, that's what God wants us to understand, but the different generation, Torah lo b'shamayim, Torah is not in heaven. And Beit Hillel understands it one way, and Beit Shammai understands it another way, and that's all fine. So basically, the 613 mitzvot, which is the basis of Judaism in certain ways, in one way is almost meaningless. We have thousands of mitzvot, and that's what we do. Who cares? Even rabbinic mitzvot, it's nice to know. It's important to know rabbinic, not, but it doesn't, in the end of the day, matter. On the other hand, sort of philosophically, understanding what Torah is all about. If you understand the Torah, the written law, that's sacrosanct, and the interpretation, that's up for people in every generation. That's now that we have a state of Israel. There was, you know, an attempt in 1948, as there was in the 1500s, after the Spanish expulsion, when a lot of Jews, a lot of great rabbinic figures moved to Israel, mainly to Tzfat, Rav Yosef Karo, the author of the Shulchan Aruch. There was an attempt back then to recreate a Sanhedrin, and maybe one day we'll get a Sanhedrin. Once people are afraid of a Sanhedrin, because when we get a Sanhedrin, all bets are off. And Judaism might become unrecognizable, both to the right and to the left, like, you, who knows what's going to be. Because for 2,000 years, you know, the people say the rabbis will get rid of Yontif Sheni. We won't have to see it. I say, I hope they add a Yontif Shlishi. I love Yontif. Anyways, okay, with that, I promise let's end even before the Raptor game a little bit. We're 2 minutes late, but it's okay. Don't worry, the game probably hasn't yet started. And I was talking to somebody on the phone one day who I don't know, something with related on Torah Motion. I had to speak to somebody in California. So he was in California. So I said to him at the end of the conversation, I don't know who this guy is. It's the first time I'm speaking to him. I said, by the way, are you going to watch the basketball game tonight? He said, sure. I said, you know, in Toronto, it's, you know, we haven't been in a finals in 26 years since the Blue Jays. The whole city's going nuts. He said, I'm rooting for the Raptors. You know what? Because I went to the same high school as Kawhi Leonard. That's what he tells me. I said, whoa, pretty impressive. Of course, he didn't know him. He didn't know him at the time, but we were in high school at the same time. And so now he's rooting for Kawhi Leonard. He went to the same high school. It's kind of cool. So with that, we'll end the Shira. Eat a Raptor cookie. Everybody, Marshall went and bought a Raptor cookie. So, and thank you very much. Okay, and please, God.
Thank you very much.
Okay, I'm, you know, when people would like to learn again, let me know, and I'm happy to come.
Oh, wonderful.
Okay.
Thank you. Thanks, Laura.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay. Bye.